From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the real cop stories behind NYPD Blue. We talk with the series co-creator David Milch and with Detective Bill Clark, who's the show's creative consultant. Many of the stories on the show are based on cases Clark investigated. Also, Elmore Leonard. He was described in the New York Times as the greatest living writer of crime fiction. His novel, Get Shorty, is the basis of the film starring John Travolta. It comes out on video this week. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton is participating in Memorial Day observances at Arlington National Cemetery. Rain fell while the president eulogized the nation's war dead. He drew attention to many in the service who die in the course of daily activity.
We have lost more than 200 of our servicemen and women in training accidents or in the course of regular duty since last Memorial Day. And though we work hard on safety, the work they do defending us has inherent dangers. And about that many Americans in uniform give their lives for our freedom every single year.
The Arlington service is one of many Memorial Day observances. New York City hosts the country's oldest Memorial Day parade honoring the nation's war dead. Clifton, New Jersey, and Twin Falls, Idaho, will have special guests. The likely Republican presidential nominee will visit New Jersey while his competitor, Patrick Buchanan, heads to Idaho. Both will participate in Memorial Day observances. There's a reported ceasefire in the 17-month-old Chechen War. Russian President Boris Yeltsin and Chechen rebel leader Zelimkhan Yandarbayev met in the Kremlin to discuss peace in Chechnya. The Interfax news agency says the reported truce will take effect Saturday. Yeltsin is campaigning hard for presidential elections 3 weeks off. He's anxious to prove to voters he's trying to end the unpopular war. It's killed 30,000 people since December 1994. The astronauts aboard the space shuttle Endeavour set a NASA record for the most rendezvous on a shuttle mission. The shuttle caught up with an experimental satellite designed to make future satellites less expensive. Pat Duggins of member station WMFE reports.
A little target practice and a closer vantage point combined to give scientists at least some of the data they wanted in the so-called PAMS experiment. Ground controllers aimed Endeavour's onboard tracking laser at the moon earlier today and bounced laser beams off the lunar surface. The astronauts then moved the shuttle closer than ever to the test satellite and focused the laser on it. NASA says the tracker eventually locked onto the satellite and began transmitting data. If the new design works out, future satellites may be able to fly on a steady course without cheating with jet thrusters. One sign on how well the test satellite is doing came today when NASA revised the estimate on how long it will take for the satellite to burn up in Earth's atmosphere. The satellite is so stable right now, it's expected to stay up until January of next year. For National Public Radio, I'm Pat Duggins reporting.
Authorities in the Midwest are recovering from severe storms and tornadoes. Missouri, Kansas, and Oklahoma were struck by bad weather. 9 people were hurt in Missouri yesterday when a strong thunderstorm moved through Lee's Summit. Kansas officials report at least 4 tornadoes crashed through the southern part of the state. The stock market is closed today. This is NPR News. Workers in Houston are hastily trying to contain a 5-mile oil spill in Galveston Bay. The Coast Guard says the oil leaked from a barge that buckled and broke open last night in the Houston Ship Channel. It was carrying 667,000 gallons of intermediate fuel oil, but it's not clear how much has seeped into the water. A Coast Guard spokesman says 2 of 12 separate compartments in the barge ruptured and other tanks could be damaged. The National Transportation Safety Board is examining the cockpit voice recorder retrieved from the ValuJet crash scene in Florida. Search teams found the recorder yesterday, 2 weeks after the jet went down, killing all 110 people aboard. Dave Mattingly reports.
NTSB Vice Chairman Robert Francis says investigators are hoping the cockpit voice recorder will shed light on the suspected fire aboard ValuJet Flight 592 in the minutes before the airliner went down.
What we'd like to hear is some sort of conversation in the cockpit or between the cockpit and the flight attendants that might give us an indication as to where the smoke and fire was coming from, or anything else that would be a clue in terms of how this was initiated. And in addition, any indication as to why they lost control of the aircraft.
Francis, speaking on NBC, says investigators are also hoping to find what's left of a circuit breaker box that was located near the pilot's seat in an effort to probe a possible electrical failure. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
The United States will be watching Iraq very closely when it starts selling oil again. Joint Chiefs Chairman General John Shalikashvili spoke in Kuwait today. He says Washington is committed to making sure that Iraqi profits from the oil sales won't be used to beef up Baghdad's military might. Shalikashvili is on tour in the Middle East. The oil deal struck between Iraq and the United Nations allows limited sales for humanitarian purposes. This is NPR.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Advanta, a financial services provider to consumers and small businesses, and the presenting sponsor of the Cezanne exhibition, now through September 1st at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
This police drama contains adult language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Previously on NYPD Blue.
Where was God when my boy got killed in that bar?
He was there.
Then he can kiss my ass.
The next time I see you, you're sober and ready to work, or you're through.
Do you want people to help you, Andy?
Yeah.
NYPD Blue ended its season last week, an eventful end for Detective Sipowicz. In the next to the last episode, his son Andy Jr. was murdered, and Sipowicz started drinking again. Last week, he sobered up. Before we meet the co-creator of the series, let's go back to the season opener. In the opening scene, a man is sitting in the police precinct in his boxer shorts. His wallet, pants, and car have been stolen at gunpoint. Detective Bobby Simone, played by Jimmy Smits, has been questioning the victim when Detective Sipowicz, played by Dennis Franz, walks into the room.
I mentioned to Mr. White this pattern we've been working on where the prostitute gets into the car and points the John to some romantic parking lot off of South Street, and then a hardworking pimp shows up and sticks a gun in his face. How we got two detectives on the street right now trying to put a stop to this before somebody gets shot. But he can't help us with that because this case is unrelated. This is a whole separate phenomenon here because there's no prostitute involved, right, Mr. White?
I told you what happened.
Mr. White told me what happened. So he can't be of help on this pattern that we've been working on where we got these two cops out on the street busting their ass. I'm feeling kind of bad now because I thought Mr. White might be lying.
Well, maybe being in a strange police station, he just can't remember right. Maybe needs more familiar surroundings.
Could that be, Mr. White?
Try taking him over to his house and talking it out with his wife in the room and see if maybe that might jog his memory.
Wait. No. I think we should do that.
All right.
My guest is NYPD Blue's co-creator David Milch. He's written much of the dialogue that's made the show so popular. Helping him to keep the series believable is Bill Clark, who's also with us. He's a former New York City homicide detective who worked on such high-profile cases as the Son of Sam and the Zodiac murders. Many of the stories on NYPD Blue are based on his work. He was still on the force when he began consulting. About a year and a half ago, after 25 years on the force, he retired and moved to L.A., where he continues to work on the show. David Milch and Bill Clark have collaborated on the book True Blue, The Real Stories Behind NYPD Blue. A little later in the interview, David Milch will quote some lines he wrote for NYPD Blue that contain language some listeners may find offensive. I asked Detective Clark about interrogating suspects. Often on NYPD Blue, during an interrogation, the cop tries to convince the suspect that he's better off without a lawyer.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that annoys me with television, other than our show, is the fact that people seem to think that the lawyer just comes in to kind of referee the interrogation so that nobody lays a hand on him and he's not intimidated. Well, the reality is if an attorney enters the room, if he allows the suspect to confess, he is then going to be sued for malpractice. So he is not going to allow him to answer any of your questions. So effectively, the interrogation is shut down the minute that he calls for an attorney. So we work very hard to keep him out of there so that we don't shut down what, in most cases, is the single biggest piece of evidence against the guy, which is a confession.
though, on the show, the cops are always trying to make it seem like it's going to be a better deal for the suspect if he talks to the cops before the lawyer comes.
Yeah, that's the biggest lie we ever tell. I mean, it's most times...
You suspects out there, Bill doesn't mean it.
Yeah. Most times when a guy sits into that interview room, if he doesn't confess, a great deal of time he'll wind up either walking back out a free man or it'll be at trial a big piece of evidence against him if he does. I'll give you an example of something. It's not my favorite subject, but the O.J. Simpson case. I think one of the mistakes that was made in that case was there was so much evidence against O.J. Simpson, physical evidence. I've never seen so much circumstantial evidence in any case, that rather than get the confession, they did a brief 30-minute interview with him and let him go. Now, with all of the so-called inconsistencies and mishandling and anything else that was brought out in trial, if there had been a confession from O.J. Simpson, he would have been convicted. There was no way that the jury could have looked past that. And that's the lesson that a detective learns very early in his career is, with a confession, it's easier for you on the stand because they're not going to beat you up as hard because they know there's a confession that they've got to deal with. And to me, that's the single biggest thing I've always worked for.
So what are some of the things that a cop might tell a suspect to get the suspect to not make that phone call to the lawyer?
Well, one of the things is you tell a guy, listen, you know, you're the guy that's going to do the time, not the attorney. He's looking to come in here for money. He doesn't care about your welfare. You know, this is the time to make the deal. It's going to help you. You can explain why you did it, the motives behind it. You know, we know you didn't mean this. It was an accident type thing. And, you know, something had to drive you to commit this act. I had a case very similar to the Simpson case a week or two before that. And a man and woman stabbed brutally. The woman was stabbed about 30 times, the man about 60. Trail of blood leaving the scene. I had the guy in about 3 days later. Excuse me. And I told him, I says, listen, you know, this is a vicious crime here. And this is horrible. I says, something had to push you over the edge to do this. You don't want to go in as a crazy man, just a vicious murderer. Something had to do it. And he explained it away that it was a jealousy thing, and he lost control. He had done a few years in jail, and he realized when he cut the first guy that he had blew it and he was going to go back, and he just lost control, and he just stabbed out of frustration. So
it's important to realize that it's so easy to simplify or oversimplify what a detective does during the course of an interrogation as one thing or another thing. There's an element of physical intimidation sometimes, but much more often, you have to be sympathetic to the guy. You have to let him know that you understand what moved him and put him in that position. And when someone is willing to cross the line the way a murderer has been by the act of committing the murder, you have to realize that the court of justice is not necessarily the thing that he or she is looking for in the course of the interrogation. They want to feel understood. They want to feel supported. There's a whole range of motivations that the detective can look to satisfy and subordinate the suspect's impulse to get someone else in there. If the person feels that the detective is his best ally, or the detective understands him, in the case Billy's talking about, when he got, that's the Flowers case, when
right.
He got the confession from Flowers. Afterwards, Flowers said he was the nicest guy Bill had ever met. This poor guy wound up dying a few days later of an asthma attack. But he felt that Billy was his best friend at the end of that interview.
Bill, would you ever make promises to suspects that you couldn't really keep in order to help get a confession?
Well, legally, you can't make promises that you can't keep. You can lie to him about things, but, you know, as far as time served and stuff like, you know, time that he would do in jail and stuff like that, you can't do. But as far as evidence that I have against him, that I have co-defendants that have flipped and stuff like that, I've lied many, many times.
That's legal. You have to understand that the legal test is you may mislead a suspect so long as the way you mislead him would not make an innocent man confess. In other words, you can't say, I have your wife in the next room, and unless you confess, I'm going to beat her, because then an innocent man might confess. But you are able to say your running mates have confessed. You are able to say, you know, we've got evidence from the scene. We recovered the gun. Because an innocent man would know that that wasn't true.
You know, this subject comes up in the book that you co-wrote together, True Blue, about NYPD Blue and the stories behind it. That David, you had asked Detective Bill Clark if he actually ever, you know, roughed anybody up to get a confession.
And, yes.
And, well, Bill, you give a description not of roughing somebody up, but of making the motions just to kind of inspire a certain amount of fear, I guess, in the suspect. You say, you know, you locked the door, took your watch off, and put your ring on the table and said, now we're going to talk about what I'm here for. You took this man's life, and you have to understand, if what it takes to make you give that up is laying hands on you, I'm going to beat you till you beg to die. Now, would you follow up on that, or is that just a threat to let the person know you're serious?
No, I would think, fortunately, most people growing up in this country have seen so many movies where cops and detectives beat a guy senseless that they, if you just make them think that we're going to get to that point somewhere along the line, it has the same effect as if you beat their head up against the wall for 2 hours. And I'm not some kind of guy that gets any pleasure out of hitting you people, so I that's not my act. But if they feel that if it goes down to the wire, that's one of the options, it's something they think about. I don't think about it that much. I'm playing a game with this guy. I mean, I've done interrogations for 12 hours before a guy confessed.
12 hours in one sitting?
One sitting, one person. I just come in and out of the room. One that I remember was a triple homicide. Guy was in for a rape that if I didn't get a confession, he was going to go in for that rape, and those three homicides never would have been solved. I really wasn't sure he did it up until about the 11th hour.
Bill, how did you keep your concentration during a 12-hour interrogation?
Well, I mean, there were times I'd step out of the room and I'd just clear my head. I mean, it is very, very tiring and at times. And the thing that you're terrified of, and I've had it happen where you've got a guy and you spend 4 or 5 hours and then you ask some stupid question that you know set it back to ground zero again. You know, you have to be very careful what you say. And
like what? What could be a setback like that?
If you're looking to get a guy to flip on his co-defendants and you say something about being a rat or something that, I mean, I'm using real bad examples, but I think you get the idea.
It gives
the
wrong emotional connotation to Bill's position.
So something that's going to insult the suspect.
Yeah, what he's right. He's looking to make the guy feel that he's sympathetic towards him. The other thing that Billy will do, and it's something that we haven't been able to do particularly successfully on the show because of the time element, is that when Billy goes at a guy, sometimes he'll have only one piece. He'll have a license plate, or he'll have the driver's license, and he may not use it for 6 hours. He'll go at the guy with irrelevancies to exhaust him or to build up a particular state of emotional receptivity. And then finally, when he uses the piece of evidence he's got, it invokes a whole range of knowledge that Bill has in the guy's mind that Billy doesn't have. And so it's a very delicate emotional framework that he's trying to generate there. And that's one reason why Billy likes to work by himself.
David, there's a scene that you wrote for Andy Sipowicz, the Dennis Franz character. He's questioning a person who he believes is a suspect in a murder. It was a white victim, and the suspect is African-American.
Right.
And the African-American man challenges Sipowicz and says, you just think I'm a suspect because I'm black. I'm black and she was white, so you think I was involved with this. And then Sipowicz starts questioning him. I want you to, if you can remember, repeat some of the lines that Sipowicz uses there.
Well, what he says is, Mr. Futrell, have I been disrespectful to you? And the guy says, my having to be here is disrespectful, because this guy's a PhD candidate at Hunter or something. And the girl had dated this guy. The white girl, who was the only surviving member of the family, had dated this black fellow who's a PhD candidate. So Sipowicz is questioning the guy. Sipowicz says, our suspect profile, you fit the profile. The girl says, sometimes you're rough. I'm wondering whether you told any of your buddies about having been in this apartment. And the guy says, in other words, I may not be a criminal nigger, but you get enough niggers together, some of them have to be criminals. So what I do is I go to my buddies and I say, I'm b***ing this rich white girl, and here's the layout of her apartment. Is that the way you got it figured, detective? And Sipowicz sort of goes at that point, and he says, look, we're investigating a murder. It so happens the assholes that did this murder were black. Now, how do you want me to go with this? You want me to say, I'm sorry for the injustice you people have suffered for the past 400 years, but did you talk to any of your friends about the homicide? Should we do it that way? And the guy says, yeah, let's do it that way. So Sipowicz says, okay, well, I know that great African-American George Washington Carver discovered the peanut, but did you tell your friends about the layout of this apartment? So now, it's quite clear. The guy says, well, you're a racist scumbag. And Sipowicz says, ouch, by which he means, you know, tell me something I don't already know.
My guests are David Milch, the co-creator of NYPD Blue, and creative consultant Bill Clark, a retired New York City homicide detective. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with NYPD Blue co-creator David Milch and retired detective Bill Clark. They collaborated on the new book, True Blue, The Real Stories Behind NYPD Blue. On NYPD Blue, there's been a lot of relationships within the force. You know, cops dating other cops.
Yes, uh-huh.
And now, of course, Andy Sipowicz is married to the assistant DA, which is related. Bill, how much of this actually went on the force in New York when you were there?
Well, you asked the wrong guy, because I'm just recently got engaged to a girl who was my partner about 10 years ago. But, I mean, it's something that was said before that I guess I didn't go into in enough detail. We spend 8 hours, 10 hours, sometimes 36 hours with your partner working in a very intense a job with dealing with all types of emotions. People have just sustained the greatest loss of their life. They've lost their husband, their wife, their mother, their father, their sister, their brother, the breadwinner of the family. I mean, all of the things that happen to somebody when a homicide happens. And you're dealing with all of those emotions, and this is the person who tries, when you get alone, when you're in the car going from point A to point B, this is the person that you talk to, and hopefully you try to make some kind of semblance of sanity out of the whole thing and feel good enough that you can go on to the next step. And it's bound to make you very, very close with that person. And if that person happens to be a female, it's is a together person who makes you, you know, it's just going to draw you closer together. Or if it's just the opposite, if you can't stand this person, it's going to drive you apart. So, again, in my experience, I've worked with several females, but as I said, one who was my partner, I've just recently got engaged to. So.
Were you romantically involved while you were partners?
No, but there was a certain attraction, there was no doubt about it. But at that point, no, it wouldn't have been the right thing.
Is that a dangerous thing on the job when you feel that emotionally involved with somebody? You know, when that spark is there, even if you haven't acted on it, because your lives are both constantly in jeopardy.
No, but I can remember, we're doing that in one of our episodes this year. You do get overly protective. I mean, this is, you know, you do cop stuff every day, and a guy goes in or a girl goes in to buy drugs or to make purchase of guns or stolen property. And naturally, if you really have heavy emotional feelings about the person or, in fact, in love with, it does become the terror can take charge there for a few minutes. It happened to me one time, I know.
What happened?
This girl who I had these feelings for was going in to purchase some stolen property, and it was a real nothing thing. It was we had six detectives on the scene, and she was supposed to give a signal when she had made a thing, and it was supposed to be done in front of the house, and she went into the house, and then all of a sudden I started getting anxiety, like, what, something must be going wrong. And it was just strictly a question of me overreacting because I had feelings for the girl.
So what'd you do? I mean, did you go in and
No, I didn't.
You just sat there and were nervous, or you, did you?
The last time I experienced that, I was in Vietnam, and it was at night, it was pitch dark, and I was in an ambush patrol, and I started hearing things, and you get to control your fear, and that's basically what it was. It was just my controlling my fear, but a fear that shouldn't have even been there.
Bill, you retired from the New York City Police as from your job as a detective during the second season of NYPD Blue. While you were still working as a detective and consulting with the series, was there a new degree of, well, almost self-consciousness that entered your work? Would you be reporting on a case and in the back of your mind see it as an episode?
No, I mean, I did my job as I saw it. I never really thought if a case went down while I was doing it that this would be a good episode. No,
Billy is not someone who is comfortable with that kind of irony or distance when he's working as a detective. He takes that very, very seriously. And I know from speaking with him about cases that he was working on all during the period when he was still an active detective, that but you know, if you're a good detective, so much of that coincides with being a good storyteller, because what you're trying to do is sort of extrapolate a whole world or a whole personality from pieces of information. And so when Billy would talk about the cases he was working on, he didn't really need to rephrase for my purposes, because just Billy being Billy, and the way I think I say in the book, you know, when Billy would work on cases, you'd watch him get sick over the cases. They would just occupy his whole being, and when a case wasn't going well, he would be miserable and you couldn't talk to him, and so he was like the most beautiful sort of prism for both the case and for a cop reacting to the case.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
David Milch is the co-creator of NYPD Blue. Bill Clark is a retired New York City homicide detective who is a consultant to the series. They collaborated on the book True Blue, The Real Stories Behind NYPD Blue. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with crime novelist Elmore Leonard. His best-selling novel is the basis of the movie Get Shorty, which is out on video this week. It stars John Travolta as a loan shark who uses his intimidation techniques to become a movie producer. We'll ask Elmore Leonard how he knows what he knows about small-time criminals and Hollywood. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The movie Get Shorty comes out on video this week. It's based on a best-selling novel by my guest, Elmore Leonard. He's one of America's most popular and most critically acclaimed crime writers. His novels include 52 Pickup, Freaky Deaky, Kill Shot, Rum Punch, and Riding the Rap, which just came out in paperback. Pulp Fiction director Quentin Tarantino cites Leonard as a major influence. Tarantino has bought the movie rights to 4 of Leonard's novels, and he convinced a reluctant John Travolta to star in Get Shorty. Travolta plays a loan shark from the East Coast who goes to L.A. to collect on a gambling debt and finds that a loan shark can feel quite at home in Hollywood. The guy who owes him money, Harry Zim, is a producer of schlock horror films. Travolta is a movie buff and figures he'd make a great producer. After all, he knows a lot about money and intimidation. Travolta gets his hands on a script he wants to produce, and he's looking for some help from the star of Zim's schlock horror films, played by Rene Russo.
I brought you a copy of the script.
Oh, I already read it. Harry left a copy at the house.
Well, how'd you like it?
Well, it's not horrible.
Well, I don't like the title, and I don't like some of the characters in it.
So you read it?
Well, I haven't read it yet, but I will.
You and Harry make a great team.
Is that right?
Listen, I'm going to make a deal with him.
Oh, good. You found out a character you like for yourself?
No, I don't want to act in it. I want to produce it, especially if I help him get Martin.
Well, hey, that's fair, huh?
Yeah. So, what do you get out of it?
Is that why you came down here to ask me that?
I want to know.
Well, why would anyone want to be in the movies?
Yesterday, you were a loan shark.
Yeah, but I was never that into it. And especially this bull about having respect. Forget about it. I mean, it's bad enough treating these guys like they're your heroes, you know? Smiling at stupid comments. They think it's so funny.
You think the movie business is any different?
Elmore Leonard, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
You write mostly in dialogue.
Yeah.
There's not that much, you know, like a lot of crime fiction, there's a lot of interior thought, a lot of like first person, just like thinking, contemplating.
Mm-hmm.
Very little of that in your novels. It's mostly dialogue. Why have you taken that direction in your writing?
I like dialogue. I've always liked dialogue from the very beginning. When I started 4 years ago, I was influenced by writers who were very strong in dialogue. Hemingway, John O'Hara, Steinbeck, a writer not many people know about, Richard Bissell in the 50s. Pajama Game was made from one of his books, 7.5 Cents. I like dialogue. I like to see that white space on the page. In the exchanges of dialogue rather than those big heavy paragraphs full of words. Because I remember being feeling intimidated back in the, say, in the 40s when I first started to read popular novels, Book of the Month Club books. I would think, God, there are too many words in this book. And I still think there are too many words in most books. But dialogue appeals to me. If I can set a scene... And this is what I do. I write in scenes, and I always write from a character's point of view so that the scene takes on the character's sound, at least to some extent. The sound even goes into the narrative.
When you started writing crime fiction, were there places that you would hang out just to listen?
I would hang out in Detroit, Frank Murphy Hall of Justice, which is the criminal court, and watch examinations, little trials, rather than the, these are the pretrial exams to find out whether a crime has been committed or not. And then finally, by 1979, 80, I was spending time with the Detroit police. And I would, I did a piece for the Detroit News on homicide section. That was the first and only piece of journalism I've ever done. And it's the kind of piece that maybe you'd spend 3 days with the homicide cops and then spend it, take a day to write it, and that was it. But I was with them at least 3 weeks before I even wrote a word, and got to know them, and they trusted me, and they showed me their case files. I could just sit there in the squad room and listen to them.
What would you say struck you as being most different about the way cops talk from the way your friends or colleagues talked?
Well, the way cops talk, they're not as educated for the most part. They remind me of professional soldiers, professional non-coms, a guy who's been a sergeant in the Army for 20 years or so. But I respected them. They really wanted to close cases. I saw that. Nobody was dragging his foot. they were all working hard, and they liked what they were doing. And that inspired me.
Now, it seems to me you're also particularly interested in colloquialisms and, you know, colorful language inventions that people come up with, little slang words.
Yeah, but you have to be very careful about using slang because expressions come into popularity and go out overnight. I remember back in 68, 69, the bounce was an expression. You probably don't even, you haven't even heard it. But I wrote a book, The Big Bounce, because the bounce seemed to be, you're looking for the bounce. You're looking for a little excitement. And I used that in a title. And I thought this was going to be a popular expression, and it didn't make it, the bounce. You know, nobody uses it now. There are things that you still hear cool, and I don't know, even some people are still saying out of sight. But you have to be... I can't rely on slang, and I don't. It's the rhythms of speech that I'm mostly interested in.
Danny DeVito plays a character in Get Shorty, who is a very much in demand actor. He's got a memoir that shows up in everybody's house or in everybody's bathroom. Everybody's reading it, and he's an actor who's very short but has a very big ego.
Uh-huh.
I wonder if you've met a lot of actors in Hollywood with very big egos who you've had to deal with. Maybe you could tell us a story without mentioning names about working with actors.
Well, Dustin Hoffman says that the book's about him. He told Rene Russo when they were doing Outbreak. Is it Break? Outbreak.
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 Yeah. Breakout would be about pimples.
Yeah.
This is about an epidemic.
Yeah. And I don't know how he did that movie in that suit, in that...
Oh, right, that space suit that you wear to protect yourself from the germs, yeah.
Yeah, the whole movie. He asked her what she was doing next, and she said, Get Shorty. And he said, oh, he said, you know, that book's about me. And he even told me that one time on the phone. He said, my people kept that book away from me because they told me it's about me.
Why does he think it's about him, and
because,
is it?
Because we had spent some months together over a period of 7 or 8 months. We had meetings about a book of mine, La Brava, that he was interested in, but came to naught. He made a deal with a studio and then decided not to do it. So, but I asked him, I said, do you recognize yourself in it? Do you see anything that... Any lines, for example, that I might have picked up from those meetings? And he said, well, no. I said, no, well, no. There are a lot of short actors in Hollywood and a lot of short stars, you know? And somewhere along the line, when I was writing the book, I thought Get Shorty was a good title. And then I thought that Chili Palmer, the character, would refer to, once they got on the track of Martin Weir, the actor, that he would refer to him as Shorty. I thought he would in the book, but he didn't. It just didn't feel right. When I would get to that part where he might refer to him that way, he didn't. And so I had the title, but no Shorty, no one referred to as Shorty. Because when Nora Ephron reviewed it in the New York Times, she didn't know who Shorty was. She called the New York Times and asked them, and then they called my publisher and say, who's Shorty? And then my publisher called me and said, they want to know who Shorty is. I said, well, at least read one of the last lines in the book in a scene where Chili Palmer, referring then to the actor, says, he's too short. And the woman, Karen, his girlfriend now, who in the book was then a studio executive, says, they're all short. You shoot up. And that was it. That was the only reference.
So is that character related to Dustin Hoffman at all?
No, not any more so than any other. He might have ordered off the menu when I was with him once or twice. Where I got the idea of actors not ordering from the menu.
Right, they have to make up something very difficult and very special that's designed, you know, a kind of customized lunch.
But he didn't do that. He didn't. He didn't go through that elaborate description of the omelet that he wanted. But everyone confirms, not everyone, but people do confirm this, that, yeah, actors don't order from the menu.
So do you like working in Hollywood, or do you find things often go wrong?
Well, it's work. And I don't think of book writing as work. That's the main difference. I'm writing a book, and I'm getting complete satisfaction. Well, when it goes right, but by the end of the day, I'm happy with what I've done because I put in a full day, 9:30 to 6 o'clock, and the time flies by. And it's the best job in the world. Journalists say to me, "He says, God, you've got the best job in the world. You sit here, you write exactly what you want. The time." Flies by. The only person I have to please is myself. Well, eventually, of course, I have to please my editor. But if your editor, your publisher likes you, knows that it can, and they can count on you, they know that you're going to deliver, then you're all set. But then you go out to Hollywood, and now you have all sorts of people to please. And wives and girlfriends too, and there's just a lot more work. There's all that rewriting, and when you're adapting your own book, your enthusiasm, your energy has already gone into the book. Now you've got to get it back up again to write the screenplay, and there'll be some new scenes in which you can exercise then an amount of energy, you know, to get excited about it. But for the most part, what are you doing? You're just kind of redoing it. So I'm not even sure if I'm any good as a screenwriter.
My guest is crime novelist Elmore Leonard. His novel Get Shorty was adapted into a film that comes out on video this week. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with crime novelist Elmore Leonard. Now, in Get Shorty, in the novel and in the movie, the character of Chili, the character played in the movie by Travolta, is always saying to people who he wants to intimidate, "Look at me."
Uh-huh.
And because the character is so confident, and because he has the power to back up his confidence, people usually get the point when they look at him. I mean, he does intimidate them.
Mm-hmm.
Then another character tries that, and it doesn't work because he doesn't have the confidence or the power to back it up.
Mm-hmm.
How did you think of coming up with that? Was there an idea behind that?
The real Chili Palmer, who worked for this friend of mine who was the private eye, once in a while were retained by the Golden Nugget in Las Vegas to call on individuals in South Florida who owe them money, not to intimidate them, just to ask them, are you going to start making payments? Be nice. There wasn't any, no violence ever involved. But my friend, the private investigator, Bill Marshall, he would talk to the guy, and Marshall is a very entertaining guy, and he would get the guy laughing. But Chili Palmer, who was sitting next to him, and he would stare at the guy and just stare and never say a word. Now, he never said, "Look at me." That I made that up. But the idea of the intimidation in that stare, I thought I could use that.
Yeah, well, his motto, Chili's motto, is actually, "Don't talk when you don't have to."
Yeah. He said, there's a line... where he says, "I'm not going to say a word to him. I'm not going to say any more than I have to, if that." And Barry keeps waiting for a laugh on that line.
And in the novel, when he's trying to intimidate somebody, he says, you know, I mean, his approach is, don't tell them what can happen. if they don't pay.
Yeah.
Just stare at them, because anything you tell them isn't going to be as bad as what they can imagine. They're going to imagine anything far worse than what you could do. So just let their imagination work.
Yeah. And Harry Zim says to him, Gene Hackman, he's, what are you, you break their legs then, huh? And Chili says, what do you mean, break their legs? How are they going to pay you if they're in the hospital with their legs broken? No, we don't break their legs.
So what did you learn about how loan sharking works from the real Chili Palmer?
Well, he really didn't get that much into it. It was just the idea that he's a loan shark. But I never got into the day-to-day what he goes through in the business, how he loans the money. Oh, there's a little monologue in the book on how he tries to dissuade someone from borrowing the money. Don't borrow this money unless you know you're going to pay it back. You're not going to sign any kind of an agreement. You're not putting up your house, but you're going to pay me this money with so much interest, and that's it, and it's your word. But please don't take it unless you know you're gonna pay me, you know. And it's quite a nice monologue, I thought, in the book. And a lot of it is from Chili, the real Chili.
Now, in your latest novel, Writing the Rap, there's a kind of unusual twist on the hostage story or the kidnapping story.
Yeah.
Would you say something about the hustle you came up with for that?
The individual who masterminds this, if that's the word, he had watched what had been going on in Beirut with the hostages. How they were kept, especially how they were blindfolded and chained or tied up, what they were fed, and he wonders, is there any money in that? Is there any money in hostage taking? And to do it right. And he thinks, yeah, well, look, if you get a guy who's got a lot of money and you blindfold him and he doesn't know where he is and you don't even talk to him for a few days or a week or so, and then finally you say, do you want to get out of this? You tell me how you can give me $2 million. You have to work it out. No ransom notes. Nobody knows this but you. You tell us how you can deliver to us a certain amount of money, a couple of million, and we'll let you go. If we don't like the idea, you're dead. So then it's up to the victim, you see? And it sounds good. Of course, in this book, the perpetrator wants to be very, very realistic about it. He wants straw mats. He wants to feed them mutton, stale cheese. He wants to do it. He wants to do it exactly the way they did in Beirut. He said, "Well, we'll put him in a basement somewhere." And his accomplice says, "Where are you going to find a basement in Florida?" Now, just everything is against him doing it the way he feels is the right way.
My guest is crime novelist Elmore Leonard. His novel, Get Shorty, was adapted into a film that comes out on video this week. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with crime novelist Elmore Leonard. Do you think you would have made a good criminal? Let's face it, in a lot of ways you have the mind. You know, you say most of your stuff isn't from research. You just, you know, sit at your typewriter and think it up.
Well, I can think of that, but I wouldn't have the nerve.
Mm-hmm. Are you a confident guy? I mean, you know,
I'm confident about my work. About right. my work. Yeah, right. But that took about 15 years, you know, to gain confidence in what you do. I couldn't imagine walking into a bank and saying, give me what money you have on top of that little alarm system that the last bill is lying on, and don't give me any dye pack, and don't give me any funny money or money with the serial numbers, you know, listed. If you know enough about it, I think you can get away with it. I think bank robbery would be pretty easily, even though 9 out of 10 bank robbers are caught. And I think mostly because they tell other people what they do, and because they're not really professional about it. They need money for drugs.
Now, a lot of your guys are talkers, and they could talk the way...
They have to be talkers.
Yeah, right. They talk the way into things and out of things. And can you do that?
No.
So you couldn't do in real life what your characters do, verbally?
Oh, no, never. No. See, the beauty of it in a scene where... You end the scene with a line, with the perfect line, you know. But you write in the book, and you have months to think about it.
Right. Now, do you, like 5 minutes or 2 days after the moment has passed, think of a good last line you could have said in real life? Or do you not think in real life in those terms?
Well, in real life... I'm sitting on a bench at Aspen, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, dead tired. I've come down the mountain. A woman skis down, 25, 30 years younger than I am, puts one boot up on the bench and says, I don't know what's more satisfying, taking off my boots or, and then she used an expression for sleeping with somebody.
And you said?
And I said, huh, like that. A little, And that was probably 15 years ago. And I've been trying to think of it doesn't even have to be snappy, just something, a decent comeback, you know.
What would you have wanted to communicate to her?
Just something clever. What would Woody Allen say? That would have been enough for me, yeah. I hadn't thought of that before either. I should have put myself in Woody Allen's. And he would have said something a little out, you know.
Well, there might have been a difference between what he said in real life or what he said in a movie.
Well, that's true. I don't think, it wasn't an invitation. She was simply describing how she felt.
Now, I know you were a drinker for many years. When you stopped drinking, did drinking change in your novels?
Yeah. No, the drinking didn't change. I had a little bit more energy then for writing, and I think my books got better. I quit in, when did I quit? 77. It's been 18 years. And I think from the late 70s into the 80s on that my books have gotten a lot better.
Did your characters drink any more or less when you stopped?
No, they continued to drink. I couldn't stop them. They were still drinking Early Times and Jack Daniels. No.
What is it still like for you to write alcohol scenes when
no problem
you can't drink
no
do you particularly enjoy it or anything is
yeah.
a way to
oh yeah yeah because they enjoy it. I have in the book I'm writing Karen Sisko the marshal and her dad who's my age are sitting in the backyard drinking Jack Daniels sipping it and talking and they really enjoy it. And I can understand that, but I don't have any desire to drink, thank God, because I know if I did, I would, I'd get drunk again. I'd become a drunk.
You started your fiction career writing Westerns.
Yeah.
Tell us about one of the Western heroes you created.
Western heroes. Did I create any?
Western characters.
Oh, yeah. Hombre. I like that character a lot, which Paul Newman played.
In the movie?
In a movie, yeah. Yeah, I thought I was very proud of that one. And also I liked Valdez's Coming, which Burt Lancaster did. Valdez's Coming is my favorite Western that I wrote. And at the time, when I read it now, I can see my style beginning to change into what I'm doing now. Really not what I'm doing now, but it began to change.
More dialogue-oriented?
A little more dialogue, a little more characters, a little more human. I'm loosening up a little bit. And that's what I finally learned, because I had studied Hemingway so closely and learned a lot, but I didn't agree with his attitude about life, about himself. He took everything himself, everything so seriously. But your style comes out of your attitude, what kind of a person you are, you know, your personality, how you see things. Are you optimistic? Are you funny? Are you grim? What? This is all out of your attitude. And once I learned that, then I had to find other writers to study and imitate.
Well, how would you compare your attitude to Hemingway's?
Well, I don't see that much. There is that much to take seriously in everyday situations that come up that people worry about, or people worry about things that might happen, you know, which is a big waste of time. I don't worry.
You don't worry?
I don't worry.
So this is one of the differences between you and Hemingway. You don't worry about things.
No.
You don't brood about things.
We know how seriously he took himself, right, with that shotgun he put in his mouth.
Right.
No, I don't see any reason to do that.
Right.
I don't take my work that seriously, and I think that's what keeps me loose. If I try to write, if I catch myself trying to write, I'll fall right on my face. I'll see it. If I see in the prose that I'm look at me writing, I rewrite it. I rewrite it because I think it's distracting.
Well, Elmore Leonard, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Terry, thank you.
Elmore Leonard, the movie adaptation of his novel Get Shorty, comes out on video this week. His novel Riding the Rap just came out in paperback. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a frank discussion with Michael Korda about his experiences with prostate cancer. He's the editor-in-chief at Simon & Schuster Publishing Company and author of the new memoir, Man to Man. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.